Hello, good evening and welcome. Good evening as I speak. I'm in the home of my very good friend Bruce Nicol. Now, I'm in the habit of mentioning a character called Bruce the Real Photographer on my blog, and we are now in the inner sanctum, his place of work. Now, Bruce, we've known each other for about a quarter of a century, it seems. We were talking about it before we went on this machine, but we first got to know each other in the early 80s.
Indeed. Yeah.
And throughout that time, you've been on a variety of photographic assignments. You did a lot of work at one time in the film industry, photoing locations for directors to look at and that sort of thing. Yes?
Correct, yes. As part of, I was running a production company down in Spain, and we basically managed the shoots. One of the things my first jollies used to be to go out and find locations for it, which meant driving around, eating and drinking, and just generally having
a good
time.
Yes, yeah. It's one of those functions you don't quite realise. It's obvious when you think about it. There have to be people doing that, but you don't hear about it very much. But you've also done lots of advertising work, sort of photographing cars, that kind of thing.
And yeah, in the good old days. Less of it now, because yeah. I think it is an ageist sort of industry.
And now you've always done lots of portraits, haven't you?
Yeah.
And if you take, I'm hoping when this goes up on my blog that there'll be a clutch of your photographs. And my opinion is that when you click on those, you will see photographs an order of magnitude more splendid than the usual stuff you see at my blog, which is mostly taken by me.
No, not necessarily. I think
you're being too modest.
But anyway,
they're very, very good, and they're very detailed. And when you print them, I mean, this is just, we're just looking at a glimpse of these things. They exist in massive files, don't they? And when you print them, they look...
They do. A lot of them are shot on a very, you know, big format camera, yes. What we call a big sheet plate camera, under the hood jobby, where you sort of pretend you know what you're doing.
And we could spend a whole time talking about purely technical stuff, sort of F numbers and whatever, all the settings of cameras and things, but I'm as much interested, in fact I'm more interested in what you might call the human side of it and the artistic side of it. You know, what goes on in your mind when you are photographing, and I think particularly what goes on in your mind when you're photographing a person, which must give an extra dimension of potential error and potential excellence to the whole thing.
Good question. The first thing I'd just like to pick up on is that although in today's world of digital photography you don't need the physics, the chemistry, the
all-night sessions in a pink room.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of craft and, if you like, science that has really gone by the window because of the fantastic instant feedback that one gets from the digital image.
And you use a digital camera now, don't you?
I tend to. Although I still use the good old under-the-hood jobby when I can afford to spend the money on the film and the processing, and the image is worth it.
So they are, as far as you're concerned, still the absolute pinnacle of it?
Well,
for certain purposes.
For certain purposes, yes. But the... what I'd like to call a sort of field craft of the nuts and bolts, the techniques of photography, have switched, I think, a lot from the, you know, the, as I said, the chemistry, which had an effect on the image, actually, in the old days, to far more computer skills. I don't call myself skilled computer operator or anything like that, but I do have a fairly reasonable knowledge of Photoshop, which is the program of choice, really, for photographers. As far as f-stops and shutter speeds are concerned, they are important, but only pictorially, not as a sort of pure technique and exposure technique. You really don't need that. You know, I've got 500 quid's worth of exposure meters, which just sit in a, you know, in a drawer, and will probably never be used again because digital camera gives you
your big fat digital camera, which must have cost somewhat more than a grand, is basically the only kit you need. Perhaps a tripod.
Exactly. It really is. It's as I said, the instant feedback you get from that that what is now actually getting to be quite a big image on the back. You can really see what you're doing. Has incredible potential to allow you to make lots of mistakes very quickly and get to.
A bit surprised to hear you say that, because obviously we idiot snappers, you know, with these little boxes costing 150 quid, we all have been completely liberated by the marginal cost of it. But you're saying something similar in a modified way has happened to
absolutely
to the real photographers.
Absolutely, but it's allowed a lot more people to enter into the game fairly quickly and just rely on sort of instinctive skills, as opposed to needing not only and this is probably what we're going to talk about a bit, how to get things and practice things till they become instinctive. So what was a very quite a long-winded training in the old days of, you know, learning the photochemistry, how to develop.
That's all gone by. There remains skills and understandings that you have, which, to be blunt about it, I don't. I see the pictures you've taken, the portraits you've taken, and I know there are things going on in your head and also in the heads of the people you're photographing, which you put there, which are special and different and something I don't understand.
Damn, but you're clever, Brian.
No, it's true. I have been photographed by you, and they were extraordinary pictures. They made me look the way I thought I only looked in my dreams.
Well, okay. Look, all I can really do is to go through a little sort of procedure as to how I approach doing a portrait, for example.
Okay, let's start with that.
And the first thing I try and sort out is when I talk to people, I mean, I know you and all, so it's less of it. But when I'm approaching somebody cold, sit around in gas for maybe 15, 20 minutes. At the same time, I'm looking for, the first thing is background.
Right.
Once I've sorted the background out, I'm halfway home. I'm always looking for a background that will not clash with, which will take the eye from the edge to the middle, help take the eye from the edge to the middle. Now, it may be a high key, i.e. something that's light, skin-toned, but different, especially when it comes to focus, because I know I'm going to try and get something perhaps out of focus. Yeah. As the background, or I may see something that requires to be in focus, and that's where, you know, your f-stops come in handy. They can bring stuff into focus, and they can make stuff go out of focus quite quickly, depending what f-stop you use. So, but it's the background that I try and sort out, primarily. It's the first thing I'm looking for, and once I've got a background sorted out, I then think about the type of lighting I need to do on my subject, or have natural lighting, say, on my subject, and it may even be shading. I may actually want to cut the light away from the person and not cut it from the background. Mm. Do you understand what I mean?
Yes.
So I'm looking for. I start looking at the lighting situation as it's going to happen with the foreground, which is the person.
Yes.
And again, that's a little bit of technique, knowing the type of light. So you can use sharp shadows, which come from bare light bulbs, to nice big window lights, or they all make a difference in the look. And we can perhaps go into that later on. But that's the next thing that sort of comes through in priority. And then the final thing is really the distance, my point of view.
Yes,
and I call it it's a POV, point of view. Now, some people look great when you're lying down, and some people look better when you're standing on a ladder looking down at them. You know, some people look good looking up at them. Some people look good looking straight at them, and everybody seems to have a slightly different distance. I think there is something quite intimidating about some smudger with a large camera and lens poking at you, that affects some people rather more than others.
Yes, I can imagine.
And again, distance is something that plays in mind. And I only really find out that once I start taking the pictures.
Right.
And I'll often, cock it up completely, start too close, and you can almost tell immediately by people's body language that they're not comfortable.
Well, that immediately brings us onto another whole issue, which is the human side of it, which is crucial, isn't it?
I think it is, and you know, the preliminary gassing with one's victim is really important. You know, you establish a sort of rapport, and as you know, consummate bullshitters, as you know, I mean, we've been bullshitting each other for 25 years on all subjects under the sun, of which we know.
Well, I mean, to put it bluntly, you're a very nice chap. So I can imagine you being better at this aspect of photography than certain other photographers.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, it's...
Rapport is not quite the same as niceness, is it?
No, I'm quite interested in the people I take pictures of, invariably. I mean, there were a few exceptions. But, I mean, in most cases, you're still interested to see what makes them tick. And I also feel quite strongly that I'm never happy with a picture unless somebody's looking... what's the word I'm looking for? At ease with themselves, you know, just sort of
in a state of repose.
Yes.
Not forcing their expression.
Exactly. I mean, sometimes they're forcing themselves physically slightly because of the shapes that sometimes work. But I'll get into that a little bit later. Mm. It's really just establishing confidence with the people.
But
that
I remember
not
when you photographed me, you said things like "move your arm."
That's right.
Things like that.
The thing, but those are purely aesthetic shape things.
Those are to get it looking good, rather
exactly
than to get me looking good.
But beforehand, you're already looking good. Because of confidence in a way. It's a bit like bedside manner.
Yes.
I suspect really, you know, good doctors, you know, actually. Half their cures are not only to do with the ghastly chemicals they're pumping into you or anything like that, it's to do with the bedside manner, the placebo effect, whatever. You know, the confidence in which they instill in their potential victims. Well, it's the same with portrait, you know, with doing portraits. Mm. I tend to veer towards rather serious portraits, actually, of people, although I want them to look happy within themselves. I don't necessarily want them to look happy.
No, you want them to look impressive in many cases.
It's sort of serious about themselves.
Interesting is what you want. That's what
people are interesting.
Yes.
You know, practically everybody is interesting in one way or another. And I'd just like to, you know, I'd like a fairly positive, if sometimes quite muted expression. I prefer something that one lingers over and looks at a little bit longer than sort of just looks at and sort of is impressed by the flash of. You know, I just prefer people. That's why I do like a lot of texture in my photographs.
That comes across very clearly in the few pictures, it gives
the eye something to sort of just savor
and the light on the faces is some of it is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, that's something that you know it is important, and it does affect how a face is perceived. And to be honest, it may be slightly intuitive as to certain shapes of faces suit certain types of lighting or seem
well,
to be better.
It must be partly intuitive, because if you've taken however many hundreds of thousands of pictures, it's a lot, there must be a sort of sense in which I think you end up with procedures that you're not even conscious of. Would that be true in some cases?
I think probably so. But when I first studied photography, which I did on my own, I bought a series of books by a very famous American landscape photographer called Ansel Adams.
Yeah, I think I've even heard of him.
Yes, he was
famous.
He was sort of the Sierra Club and all that sort of stuff. But he used to do these magnificent, somewhat overblown, sort of Wagnerian landscapes, which actually inform a lot of people of the American, you know, the American beauty of the wilderness in America. His pictures are sort of iconic and incredibly well known. But he was also a master of technique. He trained as a musician, and apparently was a pretty accomplished pianist, and in fact there are a surprising number of American landscape photographers in that fine art tradition who did actually originally train as musicians or mathematicians and stuff like that.
Well, they do say it's very good for the brain. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know.
I think it was the approach. I mean, he actually systemized the exposure, the very things that digital photography have kind of jumped by the wayside.
Automated, yes.
I've got books on this, you know, sort of semi-scientific, you know, treatises.
But you must have learned a lot of stuff that they can't put into digital cameras as well while you were reading those books.
Well, and that comes from, you know, what you do with a picture afterwards and how you crop it perhaps and
do you have any? I know some people who talk about cropping as if it was almost a moral issue.
No. You can't be dictated by, you know, some Japanese engineer who decided to make the frame 4.3 by 2.8. You know, I mean, yeah. Sod that for a game of marbles. Some pictures work absolutely brilliantly, you know, in 3:1 ratio letterbox. I mean, as long as it pleases you, go for it. You know, hopefully, quite a few other people will enjoy the experience too.
And what about the more creative ends of Photoshop and the more startling effects?
I don't use them, A, because I'm too bloody idle, and B, quite frankly, you know, it's all whiz bang, so what? You know, it's a sort of...
You lose the interest that what you're really looking to capture isn't any better once you twiddle all those knobs.
I don't think it is. I mean, you can. There are lots of things. Photoshop is effectively a tool for designers that, you know, photographers have to use. Because it's you know, it's all singing. It's the 800-pound gorilla of photo or retouching or image management, if you like.
Yeah.
And there are other software that are very good, usually quite expensive. And
no, I don't want to talk about.
No, software.
Photoshop. We know it's Photoshop. It's good.
And I have 5,000 quid's worth of darkroom equipment. Which call me if anybody's interested in it. It's sitting in sort of bubble wrap and cardboard down in Wiltshire, and we'll probably never see the light of day. It's gone. It is replaced by a £300 or £350 Epson printer.
We've covered that.
Does everything that the darkroom.
What about landscapes and cityscapes? And there's a beautiful picture of, I think it's Oxford University.
Yes, it's from the
new with fantastic detail and colour and everything. Any obviously you can't tell buildings to sort of sit up straight and all that kind of thing, but
that was shot from the College of New Tower. The Tower of New College, College of New Tower. Yeah, but it was rewind.
Don't worry.
Yeah. That was shot from the Tower of New College, Oxford. And it just so happened that we were in the pub frequented often by John Thor and Co. Morse.
Yes.
And I was being shown around. I was doing a shot for the New York Times colour supplement, you know, the Sunday supplement thing. It was the May ball issue, so it was going to come out in May. We were there in January, and just as term was beginning, they had all the freshers there and all that sort of stuff. And we were given my assistant and myself were given a young, rather spotty, as she turned out to be, Marxist sort of red-headed little girl to show us round. And it had been drizzling all day and fairly miserable, and we repaired to this pub, the name of which I can't remember, but it's very close to New College. And as we're coming, we'd had lunch, we're just slurping back some beer and stuff like that, and I suddenly noticed a ray of sunshine coming through one of the smoky windows. You could smoke in those days, this place was just sort of blue atmosphere, brilliant. And I said, right, team, come on, you know, go up the tower.
Yes.
So we piled the stuff at the bottom of the tower and locked the door because we knew we were going to do the shot. And
so you legged it up to the top of the tower.
It was a spiral staircase which got ever, ever steeper and ever, ever narrower. My rather fat assistant got stuck halfway up, and we finally dragged him up there. And lo and behold, you know, more by accident, facing due south with all the Ashmolean, Bodleian, Old Tom and all the rest of the Dick and Harry and all the rest of the dreaming spires of Oxford were then lit by these rays of sunshine coming through
the film company.
Exactly. It was sort of God doing his light and cameraman bit, and basically I just got my shit together, put the right filter on, got the exposure right, and snapped off, you know, five exposures in what, in 3 minutes, by which time the light had sort of turned absolute crap. So serendipity played a big part, and it's one of my banker images. But were I were I big time big shot photographer, I would probably go and hire a cherry picker, like a 150-foot cherry picker, and go about 200 yards back from the New College Tower in some housing estate. And so that I would get New College Tower into the image as well.
But it's not so much the completeness of the set of buildings; it's the beauty of
it. It's the light. Light. I mean, a tip for anybody.
I mean, this
go out with the camera when the weather's crap. I mean, make sure it's likely to change. I mean, if they're going to say it's going to be crap for 5 days, then you know perhaps it's better to stay at home.
But give the clouds a chance to be dark with bright light coming through.
Exactly. The most magic time happens when it goes from crap weather to good weather. That changeover is just superb.
You get those
wonderful. You see it in London. You get this black sky with a sun coming in from the west, lighting up all the buildings beforehand.
Well, the risk of complicating this conversation, 20 minutes ago, I was photographing precisely such a scene.
Exactly.
If only you had been there with that extra dimension.
Yeah, skill. I mean, we miss a lot.
Anyway, that's a good one. Go out, you know, the bad weather thing. That's
bad weather is a useful tip. I mean, I want to get back to point of view, because I think that is absolutely fundamental. And one of the tools that I've still got one, and when I'm in the car, if I'm going out cruising for snaps anywhere, I take a cardboard cutout about the size. I can't lay my hands on it.
Is it that rectangle thing?
It's literally a cardboard, black cardboard.
With their finger and thumbs.
Almost like that. But I just make a black cardboard cutout with a hole cut out in it, approximately the size of my 5.4 film, and which is nearly the size of a 35mm frame. It's, you know, give or take
a bit. And you get to see what's going on in that rectangle in a way you can't.
Yes, because it gets rid of the crap on the outside. Mm. And the closer you bring it, the wider angle it is. The further you hold it away, the more telephoto. It informs you of what is most likely to work out of your little bag of tricks.
Yeah.
A bit like having a zoom lens without lugging a bloody camera around. And it's surprisingly liberating not have to lug a camera around.
There does seem to be almost an inverse relationship between what the human eye finds magnificent and what is effective when put into a camera.
Well, bear in mind, you know, and it's interesting to note, one of the great photographers of today is a chap called Albert Watson, who's known as Cyclops. He only has one functioning eye, and this may well be a bloody good advantage for a photographer,
because he's more like a camera than
you are like a camera. You close one eye, which is invariably you do when you're looking through my little black cut out rectangle, and I swear to God, that's taken more good pictures than any individual camera I've had, because you know, I found pictures with that especially with a plate camera, you can imagine how heavy that is to lug around. That tells me, you know, approximately what lens to put on, where to put the camera, you know, because all I do when in doubt, you know, move down. If you look at the relationship between stuff that's near and far, and put your hand out like this. This is for the radio, folks.
This is not television, by the way, but never mind, let's pretend it is.
One hand's 6 inches from your nose, one hand's a foot away. Now, line them up.
Mm.
Now just move your eye up and move your eye down.
Yes.
You change the picture completely, near, far. And that's only a tiny bit of movement.
Half an inch of movement.
Exactly, half an inch
changes
of movement.
Changes the point of view radically.
Exactly.
And that's your point.
Yeah. That's my point.
Yeah.
But,
this is why you see even very good photographers adopting extraordinary postures, moving around, down, up
exactly.
and down.
Invariably, you know, most people take most pictures standing up at eye height.
Mm.
Well, some of the best pictures weren't taken at eye height. And the reason they're the best pictures is they look slightly different from what we normally see.
Yes.
And
you look twice, you think,
exactly,
funny.
Oh, gosh, that's different, that's a different point of view.
Yes.
And it might actually trigger, a lot of them are taken from about knee height,
yes,
which may be triggering all sorts of stuff in your memory of really nice things you saw when you were toddling around age 4 or 5 or 6 or 3 or whatever. In fact, there's a marvellous old French photographer called Lartigue,
Who did this, didn't he?
Well, he took pictures with a camera that he had to look down into, but when he was six, so it was literally about a foot and a half off the ground. Everything he took was from a foot and a half off the ground. And they have an amazingly good look about them.
Yeah.
They look absolutely marvellous because it's a child, real child's eye view.
Yes.
And not only were they great fun, and he organised them, and everything was set up. He loved setting pictures up. In fact, most good pictures are set up.
That's an interesting difference.
I suspect
one of the many big differences between real photographers and photographers like me is that with me, I just basically snapping away like a lunatic. And I mean, I was on my way here because the light was precisely as you described it with the dark.
Very exciting.
And the light,
everything. It looks brilliant.
And yet I don't know what sort of pictures I've got, and I can't remember any of the ones I was trying to take, and actually the only ones I was trying to take I didn't get.
Well, it can be disappointing.
And then I'll only know when I get home, but I suspect real photographers are people who can see a picture and then systematically settle down and get it.
Yes, I think
more so than somebody like me.
Well, It's a matter of training yourself. You know, I suspect that if we spent a day or 2 days just going through everything bit by bit, and you taking sort of some notes and stuff like that, one could work out, I could improve your photography out of sight just by giving you, what we're talking about now, a kind of methodology. And it sounds very rigid, but a bit like 12-bar blues.
It's not so much a methodology which suggests making things more definite. It's more
allowing more variation. Exactly.
More variation.
But allowing you to control those variations, as opposed to just being overwhelmed. A bit like when you go into Photoshop, you've got 99. You don't want that. You want less is more.
One of the things that the latest cameras are starting to have are these strange sort of screens that twiddle around, and that makes it easier to put the camera in a very
absolutely
strange, both above you below
quite.
You and round corners and goodness knows what.
I mean, just get back to point of view. That's the most important bloody thing of the lot, point of view. It's yours, it's your particular one, and there are a lot of things that can inform you as to what works best. A viewfinder, looking through the camera. I often find actually tiny little baby viewfinders aren't very good. They're too small. Mm. But a cardboard with a hole cut out is actually a lot better. Mm. You kind of get more information, strangely enough. It sort of really, it does work. And you become the camera. Once you've got the point of view, there are then various technical tricks that come in. And I was pointing out the f-stop, how the aperture can affect focus.
Yes.
And
I noticed that some of the pictures that I'm going to be showing, it's almost as if parts of the face are in focus and
other parts aren't. That's true.
That was very calculated, was it?
In most cases, yes. Sometimes you're on, you're limited by how much light you've got, and you have to make compromises. You sometimes feel that, I can't go too slow, therefore I have to open up a bit and let stuff go a bit soft, and you'll decide what to let go what to let go soft by adjusting where your plane of focus is. There are all sorts of things on the view camera that you can do to correct perspective or perspective issues, but again, all this
was photoed by amateurs.
Exactly,
yes.
But all this can be done in Photoshop now.
Yes, yes.
So again, it's made an awful lot of hard-earned skills that one learnt of the Scheinflug rule and all of this sort of stuff completely bloody redundant.
It must in a way be rather alarming for somebody like you watching the gap. I mean, the difference between you and me 30 years ago was the difference between, a molehill and Mount Everest. Now it's more like the difference between the Matterhorn and
Mont Blanc,
the Chilterns.
Whatever. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is, you could absorb. I mean, you're a bright sort of chap.
Well, I can take lots of crappy pictures.
I know, but
pick out the best or the least worst, I begin to absorb what the good ones are. In my opinion, that's all it is.
And There is a great equalization that technique has kind of been thrown out of the window a bit.
It's almost like guns, the equalizer thing.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. No, it is a terrific equalizer, and you know, all that hard work, study and things, really, you know, don't amount to a row of beans at the moment.
I don't agree with that. No. I hope that the whole burden of this conversation has been to suggest otherwise, in fact, to say otherwise.
They do, to, but not in the way that
they
were learned, you know. Yeah. It's as a result of knowing that perhaps I do have a slight advantage over somebody that doesn't understand them,
When you're taking portraits, do you ever get into what amounts to a fight? I know that as a public speaker, occasionally the nightmare occurs, and I end up facing a row of people, or a room full of people, who basically think I'm a complete idiot and hate me and don't want to communicate, don't want to hear what I've got to say. Do you ever get anything similar with
photography? Exactly. You described the one case of recalcitrant man on a job that I did for a mutual friend of ours, Jackie Denicki, who employed me to go and take loads of pictures of some people up in Warrington. Mm. And they were all troopers. They came in all sizes, large, small, you know, handsome, not very handsome, downright ugly and stuff like that. But once I managed to crack all of them insofar that they gained their confidence that we were going to do a reasonably good job. And
I'm glad we're not talking about a circumstance where it all went wrong.
No, it did. Well, various things went wrong on it.
But you corrected it.
The camera blew up.
But, oh, yes.
It's another digital disaster. But yeah. The point was that everything was going swimmingly until one guy sat down, could not crack him.
Mm.
And eventually I told him, I said, sorry, mate, you know, I'm afraid they said it couldn't be done, and they were right. Mm. It couldn't be done, and I left it at that. I wasn't going to waste too much time, you know. You suddenly realise that. So I made a rather flippant crack, and even then he didn't smile. So sod him.
So it does happen.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's definitely.
Any
in fact,
have you ever photographed super celebrities? You have. I know you have. Obviously, no names, but. Or maybe you can.
Well, yeah, I mean, models, you know, sort of not. I mean, there's recently.
And as a photographer, you are in a unique position to announce with absolute certainty that these people are really very skillful models. They are doing a very clever thing when they are photographed.
Well, clever would be over egging the pudding, but they know what they're doing, without a doubt.
They're able to do things
that
civilians couldn't do.
A lot of these girls, you know, really, they've been around the block and they know what works. Lars Schiffer, for example, sort of insists on certain type of lighting. You know, she won't stray from it either. You try anything else. Oof, no, brings that one closer, you know.
It's almost like she knows.
She would. She sat in front of, a thousand, and she recognised the ones that work. You know, she's put two and two together. It isn't rocket science, I tell you.
Mm.
You know, it may be slightly harder than, you know.
But it's things like getting the chin to look at its best and what sort of things?
What they do is they know you, well, in the old days they knew you had sort of 12 exposures to the role, and they made sure that each one you'd get something slightly different.
Mm.
So, you know, you go clack, they'd see the flash, and then they'd immediately change, give you another one. Clack, see the flash, just change a little bit more.
I wish this was on television.
Yeah, I know. I used to have great fun with a chap that I assisted once, a chap called Bill Ling, who's immensely amusing, very, very funny chap, very good photographer, beauty, fashion and beauty stuff. And he was capable of taking the piss and aping the sort of and over exaggerating in a very funny way the mannerisms of all models that have existed since the beginning of time, including their catwalk, which was quite the most hilarious thing I've ever seen.
And did he succeed in melting these?
Oh, they all adored him. Yeah, yes. he was a heterosexual one, which, you know, was kind of rare, especially in the 80s. And, he was very, very amusing guy and had a lot of fun.
And of course, you could see that in the pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I knew another fashion informed me a lot, actually. When I was assisting, I used to do a lot of fashion with some quite well-known names like Terry Donovan and people like that. Mm. And again, it tells you the most important thing is the guys that treat their people usually well, nicely, and they get a lot out of people. You know,
it's a human thing as much as a mechanic.
Have a bit of fun and stuff like that. And the other thing is casting. A chap I used to work for, Richard Imrie, had basically Debrett's in his file of facts. He knew everybody, Mickey Suffolk, you know, the Earl of Suffolk, Duke of Suffolk, and Christ knows what, you know, and was always ringing these people up, you know, to rent a bit of the castle for the weekend for a shoot, which he always got at knockdown prices because he was bringing lots of gorgeous looking crumpet down there, which the old boys, oh yes, splendid, yes, you know, a few hundred quid and done, and then it was sorted. But Richard had an absolute masterstroke. He used to do loads of stuff for large, high-end retail things like Austin Reed, Dunhill, that sort of stuff. And Richard worked almost exclusively with a French model called Frédéric Lugache. He was one of these nauseating people. Not only, he was immensely handsome, but terribly witty. Mm. Very funny, great bon vivant, and just an all-round good egg. Plus, you know, extremely heterosexual, sort of oozed pheromones or whatever it is, and the girls absolutely adored him. Well, it just meant Richard had bugger all to do. Mm. Basically, you know, you just set Freddy loose amongst the girls and react into them. Mm. And, you know, you just sat there just taking pictures.
Well, you'd appreciate that hiring the most gorgeous Frenchman on the planet isn't something that your average photographer might be able to do. Now, let's just
I digress.
No, you digress, but why not? Yeah. This is only podcasting. It's not the BBC.
It's not,
they're not going to fire me.
Desert Island Discs. Exactly. Now I'd like
exactly.
to play.
Anyway, let's just go through the big points. Point of view is that if you're only allowed to say one thing, you say point of view. That thing about the weather was very interesting. Mm. Bad weather.
Often a good idea if you're you know, looking for landscape.
Background first.
Well, yes, this is looking at portraits.
Any other kind of propositions of that order of importance that we've forgotten?
I think if you can get contrasts contrasts in lighting between the foreground and the background, you split it up between foreground and background.
Yeah.
And often simple things like cross lighting that you'd light. Say, for example, you had two lights on stands, mm-hmm. which, you know, most people can afford if you want to do serious
portraiture. What do you think of flash?
Oh, marvellous. I hate it.
But that's because I don't know how to do it. All I do is turn everybody into red-eyed monsters.
Yeah, no, but I have large flash machines. Off on the side.
Oh, that's completely different. My first camera had a flash that you could separate from the camera. That was wonderful. Never worked out how to do
Let me just see. It's foreground, background, you know, these are things that you can separate. You can look at them separately. Well, the background's the first thing to work out because it tells
harder
you...
Harder to change.
Well, it's almost impossible to change once you've set up, you know. And so sort the background out first and everything else kind of falls into place. Use things like umbrellas to shade people.
Yes.
It's quite interesting. If you have a background that's lit by the sun and a foreground that somebody's in the shade...
Well, they have those big... people standing about with I mean, I was at Lord's the other day, and there was a bloke standing over the big circle.
Circle, yes.
He was bouncing light.
Elephant's diaphragm. Yes, that's right.
Towards
the mob.
Whoever it was.
But, you know, equally an umbrella can do a job of separating, and the eye realises, hang on, there's a difference here. It doesn't know quite what it is, but it notices that the light on the you know, if you shade somebody, it's all soft and nice.
Yes.
Whereas...
And there's nothing to stop a complete amateur doing a thing like
absolutely
that.
Nothing. No.
In fact,
most of these, you know, magazines like Amateur Photography have articles, you know, on perhaps not that particularly, but, you know, there's some pretty good amateurs out there. In fact, I'm almost at the stage where I'm an amateur.
Doing it for
the love of it, you know, as opposed to huge remuneration. But
well, anyway, I think we're done, unless you and any other brilliant thought occurs to you in the next 10 seconds. Bruce Nicol, I don't know if I actually said that's who you were.
Let the cat out of the bag.
And the date, which I might as well say roughly, it's the beginning of August 2006, if any historians are eavesdropping on this. And thanks very much indeed.
Pleasure, Brian.
A lot of fun. Thank you.